headlines, Iran warns the European Union against irrational acts of meddling over recent riots in the country, saying it will respond in kind to any new measures by the bloc. Several explosions hit a central area in Ukraine's capital, Kiev, amid reports of intense fighting between Russian and Ukrainian forces in Donbass. And Brazil's incumbent President Jair Bolsonaro and his leftist challenger Lula da Silva trade jabs. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Tehran is warning the European Union against irrational acts of meddling against Iran over the recent riots in the country. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani says Iran will respond in kind to any new measure by the bloc or its member states. Kanani is also slamming European countries for applying double standards to riots in Iran and elsewhere. Kanani says that they are calling on Iran not to counter riots while they countered rioters in their own countries. Some European officials have criticized Iran for its response to the unrest that followed the death of a young Iranian woman last month. The European Council is set to discuss the issue in a meeting on Monday and could impose sanctions on Iran. The Iranian judiciary says four more inmates have died due to the blaze at Tehran's Evin prison on Friday. The prisoners were earlier said to be in critical condition. Their deaths take the number of lives lost in the fire incident to eight. The judiciary earlier said dozens of inmates were also injured. The blaze started at the prison sewing workshop following a brawl involving a group of prisoners. Meanwhile, security guards said that they foiled an attempt by prisoners to break out. By some inmates convicted of violent and dangerous crimes, the situation has now returned to normal. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has launched a military drill in border areas in the northwestern provinces of Iran. The exercises are conducted by the IRGC's ground force in the Aras River region, which borders Azerbaijan and Armenia. On the agenda of the drills are heli-borne operations, night combat, and river crossing exercises. Among others, helicopters and various types of drones will also be deployed. The ground forces commander, Brigadier General Mohammad Pakpour, says the exercise is part of their scheduled annual missions aimed at boosting their combat readiness. Pakpour says the drills send a message of peace and friendship to neighbors and a message of a warning to enemies that armed forces will give a firm response to any threat. The British capital, London, has hosted this year's annual Islamic Unity Conference. The event brings together religious leaders of various Muslim sects together under the roof to promote peace and combat division. This year's conference comes amid a global campaign targeting the Islamic Republic of Iran. Robert Carter reports.
Muslim religious and community leaders from a variety of sects gathered in London on Sunday for the 24th International Islamic Unity Conference. The annual event, held at the Islamic Centre of England, aims to promote religious unity, combat sectarianism, and defend Islamic values.
This event coincides with a similar Islamic Unity Conference held annually inside Iran. The Islamic Republic has come under a sustained attack in recent weeks by Western groups advocating for regime change following the unfortunate death of Iranian woman Mahsa Amini.
Many groups are involved in backing the anti-Iran riots, most notably Western-based Iranian dissidents and supporters of the MKO terrorist group. Although they are divided on doctrine, one factor unites them: Islamophobia.
They are hijacking maybe an agenda to portray this clash of civilization, and they are portraying this narrow-minded, neo-conservative narrative that Muslims are barbaric, Muslims are narrow-minded, and Muslims need to be liberated. And this was the type of language that was used at the dawn of the second and the first Gulf Wars, of trying to say we need to liberate Muslims, We're here to liberate their countries, and this is very dangerous.
These are actual people who have an agenda to make Muslims and Islam enemy number one across the world. So whether it's targeting the Islamic government and the Walayat-e Faqih system in Iran, or whether it's attacking a woman with hijab on the streets of East London, actually the phenomena is rooted in the same thing. It's an actual organized attack on Muslims.
The anti-Iran riots have expanded to include an international campaign condemning Islam and Islamic concepts, such as the hijab. It's now up to Muslim leadership to find ways of combating the tide of anti-Muslim abuse. Initiatives such as this intend to inspire a fight back. Robert Carter, London.
Several explosions have hit the Ukrainian capital for the second time in a week, damaging several residential buildings. Officials say that the city was struck five times in early morning hours. Kiev's mayor says that at least three people are killed and several others have been hospitalized. Separately, officials in Ukraine's eastern region have said that a big fire broke out at an energy facility there after a missile hit it. Meanwhile, Ukraine's prime minister says Russian strikes target critical infrastructure in three regions, knocking out electricity to hundreds of towns and villages across the country. Russian and Ukrainian forces are also engaged in heavy fighting around Donetsk and Lugansk in Ukraine's eastern Donbass region. We talked to our correspondent Johnny Miller from Donetsk with more on the latest attacks.
In Kiev today, we're woken up by the sound of Russian bombing of the capital. It's not clear all the targets yet. You mentioned the train station. It's also looks like it's been confirmed that the headquarters of the main Ukrainian energy company has also been hit. This is in line with Russia's new policy to start hitting civil infrastructure and particularly power stations, energy infrastructure. This, of course, helps to inhibit Ukraine's ability on the battlefield, but also will make life more difficult for civilians. So, as you mentioned, Russia has been hitting Kiev and other cities increasingly over the last week, and that looks like it'll set to continue. Countries are calling for their citizens to leave Kiev as the expectation that this bombing will continue.
A senior Russian official warns Israel against supplying weapons to Ukraine, saying it would destroy all bilateral ties between Tel Aviv and Moscow. Deputy chairman of Russia's Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev, says that it would be very reckless for Israel to deliver arms to Kiev. Ukraine has asked Israel for military supplies, including the Iron Dome anti-missile system. Israeli officials are yet to grant the request. However, the Israeli prime minister has criticized Russia after it launched a barrage of missiles against Ukrainian cities last week. Clashes have erupted between French police and angry demonstrators who rallied in the capital, Paris, to protest against soaring living costs and climate inaction. Police used tear gas and pepper spray to disperse the protesters, who in return threw objects at security forces. The protesters were also pushing against proposed pension reforms. The demonstration was called by left-wing political parties backed by hundreds of associations. France has already been hit by weeks of refinery strikes that have caused fuel shortages across the country. The workers demand wage hikes to cover inflation and include a share of the huge profits made by oil companies. The prime minister has warned the striking industry workers that the government might use force to bring them back to their jobs in order to ease the fuel shortages. Local commentator John Stepling explains how the people in France are finding it difficult to get by with the ongoing cost of living crisis.
The cost of living has risen so precipitously. The gas prices are amazingly high, even in Scandinavia here. Food prices have risen far beyond anything that's actually even reported. And again, this is true even in a country like Norway. So people are reaching a point where it's not sustainable for them. And winter, of course, is coming, and the prospect of having to heat your house in the winter months, especially in northern European countries, is causing people a great deal of anxiety. And the governments of Europe have no answer for this. In the EU, Ursula von der Leyen just keeps repeating the same sort of mantra about we have to send weapons and money to Ukraine and so forth. Prices are just unrealistically high. I mean, impossible for people to survive if they stay at this level. Impossible for them to heat their homes in winter if they stay at this level. Just literally impossible.
As the energy crisis continues to bite in Italy, people from all walks of life have been staging protests across the country, from students to workers. Italians are urging the next government to put the community back in the center of political discourse and work for peace. Max Civilli reports.
On Saturday, anti-government rallies and protests were held in the Italian capital. In the morning, high school students took to the streets of Rome to stage a protest that converged on the education ministry. Pupils were demanding more investment in education after what they called two decades of budget cuts and the country recording the highest school dropout levels in the EU. They sent out a warning to the next government, saying Italian schools must be upgraded to be of quality standards.
We are still wondering why the government hasn't scrapped a 2015 school reform. We demand the next executive to put an end to obligatory work placements in the last 3 years of school and to declare a state of emergency for Italy's school buildings.
Later on Saturday, hundreds of people held a demonstration not far from the government building. The initiative was organized by a recently formed anti-system movement called Sovereign and Popular Italy. At the demonstration, people urged the next executive to do more to shield families and companies from surging energy prices and to stop sending weapons to Ukraine and find ways to promote peace internationally.
We want to stress how the lies told by the mainstream media on the conflict in Ukraine have brainwashed the Italian people. It's NATO who declared war on Russia using Ukraine as a tool. An end must be put on this historical phase made of imperialistic violence and the longing for expansion.
Italy is in the process to install a new government as the Mario Draghi government collapsed in July, leading to snap elections. The far-right formation Brothers of Italy has emerged as the party garnering the most support from Italians in the vote last month, and its leader Giorgia Meloni is slated to become Italy's next prime minister. More protests were held in Italy over the past days. Earlier this week, operations were suspended for 24 hours at Genoa Airport following a demonstration called by the Ansaldo Energy plant's employees against plans to close the factory. Also, the Italy's largest union, CGL, staged a large demonstration in Rome about a week ago, demanding more protection for workers. A hot autumn of protests and strikes seemed to have just started in the country. Max Civilli, Rome.
Top EU diplomat Josep Borrell is under increasing fire for a recent analogy that he made. In it, he drew what many have described as a racist and offensive contrast between Europe and the rest of the world. The remarks sent social media into a frenzy. Let's take a listen to some of those reactions. But first, this is Josep Borrell himself.
Yes, Europe is a garden. We have built a garden. Everything works. It's the best combination of political freedom, economic prosperity, and social cohesion that the humankind has been able to build. The rest of the world, and you know very well, Federica, is not exactly a garden. The rest of the world, most of the rest of the world, is a jungle. And the jungle could invade the garden. And the gardeners should take care of it in order to protect the garden. The gardeners have to go to the jungle. The Europeans have to be much more engaged with the rest of the world. Otherwise, the rest of the world will invade us. by different ways and means.
Is Africa still a jungle only meant to furnish someone else's garden, as it has painfully been so? You looted the jungle for generations to build your garden. Sit down. Years ago, war criminal Prime Minister Ehud Barak described Israel as a village in the jungle. Today, EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell describes the EU as a garden in the jungle. These truly are the shared values of these putrid racist colonialists.
This racist's garden only grows because of everything he and those he represents steal from the jungle.
International human rights lawyer John Felpot takes a closer look at Europe's history, contradicting Borrell's claims.
Our common sense will tell us it is racism, but we have to look at European history from the slavery period or even after 1885 when they took over and divided Africa. There is a long history of Europe's supremacy, which has been replaced largely a lot by American supremacy. And the term jungle, I mean, I grew up in English Canada. The jungle has a connotation of uncivilized people. I don't believe that, all right? But I grew up as an English-speaking Canadian with those concepts, which are deeply inside us. And so this is what the European supremacy is all about. And let's just look at recent history. The war on Algeria, when France killed so many Algerians who wanted to be independent. The jungle is the behavior of the French soldiers. The war in Kenyan independence movement fight, I think it was 200,000 people. A lot of them were Kikuyu people in Kenya, were killed by the British. The jungle is the British behavior, not the African, the Kenyan behavior. We see them imposing sanctions on Ethiopia to try and make people poor and starve and not be employed. Who are the people who are acting by the laws of the jungle? We talk about the term laws of the jungle where there's no rules. It's the West which is doing it.
The candidates in Brazil's runoff presidential elections have traded jabs and insults in their first debate 2 weeks to go before the vote. Leftist challenger Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva attacked far-right incumbent Jair Bolsonaro by calling him a little dictator and a king of fake news. Bolsonaro pushed back, calling Lula a national shame, and handling the COVID-19 and corruption were the main issues that were discussed. Meanwhile, according to the latest opinion polls, Lula enjoys 49% support and against 44% of Jair Bolsonaro. Both fall short of the 50% threshold needed to win the presidency in the first round of elections on October the 2nd. And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Virtues of the Believers, Friday the 3rd of Ramadan, 1394, the 20th of September, 1974. For Allah, there are no dead ends for us. In Allah's hands, every dead end is a door. There is always a way. Is there a dead end worse than the Battle of Uhud? For Allah, there are no dead ends for us. In Allah's hands, every dead end is a door. There is always a way. Is there a dead end worse than the Battle of Uhud? What dead end? Even if the Prophet of Allah has been slain, Allah, the God of the Prophet, will never be slain. We still have our moral duties. In such a situation, how will a person who places their trust in Allah behave? Like the commander of the faithful, Ali ibn Abi Talib, like Abu Dajjanah, like those few who stood their ground, those who had no trust in Allah, who were they? Those who fled for their lives back to Medina without ever looking back, who ran until they were safely inside the city. Now you can see the meaning of tawakkul. Those who fold their arms in the name of tawakkul, who sit back and do nothing in the hope of some unknown future, choose to forsake their own faith and their own power as human beings. Those who think tawakkul means to strike out human free will and human ability either do not understand tawakkul or they understand it perfectly but want to change its meaning in the minds of others so they will no longer place their trust in Allah. But when Allah says the faithful are those who put their trust in their Lord, He means that the human being has two powerful wings to carry them through life. One is steadfastness, sabr, and the other is relying on Allah, tawakkul.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Any nation which has these two wings will fly beyond the reach of their enemies, the wing of steadfastness and the wing of reliance, and who put their trust in their Lord. This is the third quality of the faithful. Fourth, who maintain the prayer. Now, pay attention to the expression Allah uses here. Consider the difference between those who pray, الَّذِينَ يُصَلُّونَ, and those who maintain the prayer, الَّذِينَ يُقِيمُونَ الصَّلَاةِ. If Allah was only referring to those who say their prayers, there would be no need to say those who maintain the prayer, because the use of the word maintain would be superfluous. Allah could have just said those who pray and be finished with it. Clearly, those who maintain the prayer are not the same as those who pray. There is something else there too. There is some higher reality. What do you think this could be? What does it mean to maintain prayer? There are several possibilities, any one of which could be correct. One is that maintaining the prayer means performing prayer perfectly or completely, as this is one of the meanings for the verb iqama, to maintain, in Arabic.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Whether signed in the White House or overseen by a U.S. President or Secretary of State, the United States has almost always had a role in any and all negotiations between Palestinian and Israeli sides. Looking at some of the more important instances of these talks, one can think of the first Oslo Accord in 1993 that was signed in Washington in the presence of then-U.S. President Bill Clinton. The 1999 Sharm el-Sheikh Memorandum that was signed in Egypt was also overseen by the U.S. through Madeleine Albright, then Secretary of State of the Clinton administration. The unsuccessful Camp David summits in the year 2000 was overseen directly by Bill Clinton himself. Following the unsuccessful peace talks, Clinton would make another effort at influencing the Israeli-Palestinian relations through the aptly named Clinton parameters, showing the extent of his and U.S. involvement in the talks. Sometimes this influence even meant that the fate of Palestine would be discussed without the participation of any Palestinian representative, as was the case in the Camp David Agreement in 1978, which was signed by Egyptian President, Israeli Prime Minister, and then US President Jimmy Carter, without even an Arabic version of the documents. These showed the never-wavering U.S. Pledge of Allegiance to Israel, a pledge that will always protect Israeli interests which would automatically go against Palestinian interests. Among the most important of these interests is a trinity of inalienable rights defined by the Palestine National Council in 1974, which consists of Palestinians' right to self-determination, an independent state, and most importantly, right of return. The most recent example of neglecting these rights occurred in 2020. During Trump's tenure, the deal of the century was presented, which many later called the flop of the century. The Trump peace plan was titled Peace to Prosperity, a vision to improve the lives of the Palestinian and Israeli people. But it was far from that. The plan had been delayed by 2 years and previously rejected by the Palestinians, who were not invited to the meeting. The plan never materialized, however, since, again, it was not representative of the Palestinians' rights on major core issues of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The first time Israel attempted to make the smallest bit of compromise was at the Camp David summit in 2000. Israel said it would be willing to allow 100,000 Palestinian refugees back to their homeland, while the millions of others had to be resettled wherever they were at the time. Also, Yasser Arafat, then chairman of the Palestine Liberation Organization, would have to forego the idea of right of return completely from then on. Similar ludicrous proposals that were rejected by Arafat were all proposed with the US being on board with these proposals. The US involvement in the so-called peace talks have time and again shown Palestinians and their officials that the US is not to be trusted as a neutral party. On the sidelines of the sixth summit of the Conference on Interaction and Confidence-Building Measures in Asia and Kazakhstan, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas had a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. In it, he expressed that he is happy with Russia's position on Palestine. He also said that he would only accept U.S. involvement in the conflict resolution process if other parties of the Quartet on the Middle East were present. The Middle East Quartet, established in Madrid in 2002, is a foursome of nations and international and supranational entities involved in mediating the Israeli-Palestinian peace negotiations. Its members are the United Nations, the United States, the European Union, and Russia. Palestine's hand is now one of unity, since the Palestinian factions have all established peace amongst themselves, including Hamas and Fatah. Palestinian factions signed reconciliation agreements in Algeria. Hamas, Fatah, and 12 other Palestinian groups agreed to hold legislative and presidential elections within 1 year after the successful talks held in Algiers. Meanwhile, when it comes to peace talks between Israel and Palestine, Abbas has stressed that Washington should not be given free hand to act alone in resolving the decades-long Palestine-Israeli conflict.
The rising rivalries between the U.S. and China are set to dominate the coming years in the 21st century. That is because the U.S. has unveiled its long-delayed national security strategy, where China is named as the most consequential geopolitical challenge for the regime in Washington. That means that Washington is prioritizing winning over China, as Beijing is seen as the only global rival to the U.S. Jake Sullivan, the U.S. National Security Advisor, said, "The People's Republic of China harbors the intention and increasingly the capacity to reshape the international order in favor of one that tilts the global playing field to its benefit." The U.S. strategy further insists that China represents the most consequential challenge to the global order. It also says the U.S. must win the economic arms race with the superpower if it hopes to retain its global influence. The strategy has warned that China's rapid advances in technology is aimed at molding the world order. The strategy is in line with the rhetoric pursued by the Biden administration and his predecessor. Biden officials have accused Russia and China of looking to change the so-called rules-based order. The term has come to be seen as a synonym for Washington-led world order. The Biden administration has entangled itself in a number of global crises, including the war in Ukraine. The Washington regime encouraged the war in Ukraine by sending more weapons into the conflict zone. Washington is using the crisis to contain Russia. And by encouraging its allies to sever their energy ties with Moscow, Washington is trying to push European countries into its own sphere of influence. Furthermore, Washington is stoking tensions in the East Asia region by strengthening its ties with the Chinese Taipei. Back in August 2022, the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan, drawing an angry reaction from China. Beijing has warned that it will not tolerate Washington's meddlesome interference in its own affairs. But Washington's increasingly belligerent behavior in Europe and East Asia has pushed Russia and China closer together. They have forged closer ties in a variety of fields, including energy, business, and defense areas. Furthermore, both Moscow and Beijing are key members of the BRICS groups of countries and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Two bodies are playing key roles in shifting the Western-led balance toward a multipolar world. Russia and China have also forged closer ties with countries like Iran and India, which are emerging powers in the shifting geostrategic relations worldwide. It is now widely believed that Washington's ambitions to still lead the world is facing tough challenges. It appears that the regime in Washington has no longer the capability that it once possessed to dictate its hegemony.
Iran hosting the 36th International Conference on Islamic Unity in the capital Tehran, which hosts 200 Shia and Sunni clerics as well as thinkers from some 60 different countries. The annual event puts into discussion the challenges faced by the Muslim world. It's widely believed that uniting Muslims in the region and worldwide would be a great step in alleviating the problems they're facing. Violence and wars are killing Muslims in Yemen, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria. Imam Khomeini, the late founder of the Islamic Republic, proposed the idea in the 1980s to bring Muslims together against the imperialist aggressions and interventions of Western powers. Over the years, Iran has championed the cause of Islamic unity and brotherhood. This is when many other Muslim countries have brazenly become facilitators and enablers of America's neo-imperialism. The highlight of this year's event was a speech by Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi to the participants of the conference. During his speech, President Raisi hailed resistance as the only viable path to confronting the Israeli regime. Raisi further said that history has proven wrong those countries who assumed that negotiations would save Palestine.
The biggest human rights violators are the US, Israel, and some Western countries, despite their claims to be human rights defenders. See their record, what they have done to their own people and the people around the globe.
Raisi also referred to previous deals reached with the Tel Aviv regime on the issue of Palestine, saying the regime has refused to honor the commitments it has made. He also criticized the Arab governments that normalized their ties with Israel and the Zionist regime. He said the US and the Israeli regime are trying to marginalize Palestinians through normalization deals. Raisi was referring to the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco, which normalized their ties with Israel in late 2020 under deals pushed by former US President Donald Trump. One of the issues that was highlighted in this conference was how Muslims in Palestine are brutally oppressed by the Israeli regime, which is supported by the West and some regional Arab states that have betrayed the cause of Palestine. The normalization deals with the Israeli regime has emboldened Tel Aviv to carry out more war crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories.
It's no surprise to us that the House of Saud has teamed up with the Israeli regime. They claim to be Muslims, but in fact they are the puppets of the Israelis and do what Tel Aviv dictates to them.
So far this year, more than 100 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds amid a massive increase in Israeli military raids. Israel has killed five times as many Palestinians in 2022 than it killed in the same period in 2021. And on the issue of Palestinian prisoners, nearly 300 rights groups have condemned the continued detention of Palestinians in Israeli prisons. They called on the international community to act against the crimes of Israel. The groups also censured Israel for its administrative detention of Palestinians. Conferences like the one held in Iran helped the Palestinian cause by continuing to point to the atrocities committed by the Israeli regime. If the Palestinian cause is not the most important issue for Muslims and the wider world, then Israeli forces will continue using excessive force in their dealings with the Palestinians without being held accountable.
The French leaders have seemingly found a solution to the country's energy crisis. Puffer jackets and turtlenecks have become the newest fashion trend in the Élysée, as ministers and the president try to imply a message to the public: wrap up warm for winter. That's while, as the cold season approaches, the nation struggles to afford heating. French motorists have been made to wait in long lines across the country to refuel their vehicles as petrol pumps run dry amid ongoing strikes at the country's oil refineries and storage sites. Almost a third of the petrol stations had problems getting deliveries of fuel as tanker drivers continue their strike over low wages and harsh working conditions amid a cost-of-living crisis in France. So, to cut the long story short, Macron is up to his neck in trouble, and his government's winter wardrobe messaging has drawn accusations of being out of touch with everyday reality. The country's far-right opposition leader, Marine Le Pen, mocked the government saying, "Don't have enough heating? Let them wear cashmere." And Gaspard Ganser, an advisor to former President François Hollande, labeled the idea grotesque and paternalistic. Paris has come up with an energy efficiency plan to get through the winter without blackouts. Homes and offices heated to a maximum of 19 Celsius degrees. No hot water in public buildings, no lit advertising overnight, a ban on doors left open in heated or air-conditioned shops, reduced temperatures in swimming pools and gyms. These are some examples of the action France is taking to save energy. However, environmentalists have accused the French government of promoting tiny measures while failing to take enough action on the climate crisis. They say unenforced and voluntary measures are ineffective. Also, scores of French intellectuals have urged the nation to rise in protest against President Emmanuel Macron's failure to improve economic conditions amid rising inflation. The current situation troubles the French government as a foretaste of problems to come, a potential winter of discontent. Now, the question is, will Macron get his head out of his turtleneck? Thousands of demonstrators gathered in Paris to protest soaring inflation and high cost of living, demanding that France pull out completely from membership in the US-led NATO military alliance. They demanded that President Emmanuel Macron resign, calling on his government to stop supplying arms to Ukraine. Ever since the Ukrainian crisis began, causing a severe energy crisis across Europe, anti-NATO sentiments have been rising among Europeans. Similar protests have been held across the European Union against soaring inflation and the rising cost of living caused by sanctions imposed on Russia in the wake of the Ukraine war. Since the beginning of the war in Ukraine in late February, Western countries have slapped waves of sanctions on Russia. In response, Moscow has either choked up or lessened its gas exports to the rest of Europe, saying it would only resume the gas flow after the economic sanctions were lifted. Disruption in supply chains has led to higher fuel and food prices across the EU, driving inflation to record levels and causing the cost of living to soar. The European Union leaders accused the Kremlin of wielding energy as a weapon, cutting gas supplies in retaliation for sanctions. The protesters also called on the US-led NATO coalition to immediately stop supplying arms to Ukraine and to work to resolve the simmering crisis through diplomacy.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illa Allah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
This is a part of political divine will of the founder of Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini. His Holiness Muhammad and Prophet of Allah, peace be upon him, and his pure progeny has said, I leave among you the Thaghalain, the Book of Allah, and my Itra. Verily, they will be inseparable from each other until they join up with me at the pool of Kauthar. References to this noble hadith are frequently made in such reliable Sunni sources like the famous Sixth Correct Texts, as well as in countless cogent Shia texts. Thaghalain hadith has been narrated in several occasions by the Holy Prophet of Islam. This tradition has been accepted as an irrefutable proof for all Muslims regardless of their schools of thought. For the Muslims who are informed of this tradition, it is incumbent to act upon it.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, sisters and brothers from all over the world, you're listening to the program Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio, and this is your humble host, Zainab Mousavi. Well, in this new episode of Spring of the Truth, we will discuss and elaborate on Imam Khomeini rahmatullah's viewpoint about the great station of a mother. You know, considering the importance of the nature of a mother, Imam Khomeini says that good mothers train good children. And again, this great character has several quotings and sentences about the great role of mothers. He again says that if the mothers are chaste, they will deliver chaste children. And again, if God forbid a mother is pervert, the child that will come out from her lap will also be a pervert. You can see that he is referring to the importance of the nature of a mother. And this sentence is aligned with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's words in the fifth verse of Surah Al-Maryam, saying that the Messiah, son of Maryam, was not but a messenger, and his mother was a supporter of truth.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi. Sallallahu alayhi. Salli ala
We can see that the nature of Saint Maryam, who was a follower of the truth, was so good and acceptable that even her progeny, the Prophet Isa alayhi salam, is again a follower of, a faithful follower of the religion, and a good person too. In our surroundings, even, there are lots of mothers whose view on specific issue is transferred exactly in the same way to their children. If a mother deprecates lies, backbitings, or immoralities in general, definitely she will transfer her way of thinking to her child, and the child would at least, if not practicing the same way, reprehend these vices. And on the other hand, if a mother is pious, is honest, definitely the children would be different from others too.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. As you know, on this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss how India continues to defy U.S. sanctions to import crude oil from Russia, making clear it won't toe the Western line on the Ukraine war. And we shall also look at the second wave of catastrophe in Pakistan amid the spread of waterborne diseases and food crisis after the devastating floods.
Defying U.S. sanctions and saber-rattling, India has explicitly reiterated that it will continue importing oil from wherever it needs to, including Russia. India's oil minister made these remarks during a recent visit to Washington as the standoff between Russia and the West intensifies over Ukraine. The simmering war, now in its eighth month, has greatly disrupted the global energy market, affecting supply and demand patterns and trading relationships. But India, as an emerging economic giant, has withstood the pressure to snap its time-tested trade ties with Moscow.
Following his meeting with U.S. Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm on October 8th in Washington, India's oil minister Hardeep Singh Puri made it emphatically clear that his country will not toe the Western line on the Ukraine war. He said New Delhi has not been told by anyone to stop importing oil from Russia, asserting that it will continue to buy oil from wherever it has to, keeping in view the government's moral duty to provide energy to the people. The remarks came as soaring energy prices amidst the Ukraine war have begun to bite people around the world, hurting households and industries. India, a close ally of Russia, has refused to join the Western coalition in boycotting Russian energy. Instead, the Narendra Modi government in New Delhi has ramped up crude oil imports from Russia since the Kremlin launched its military operation in Ukraine in February. On the OPEC Plus consortium's decision to slash oil production by 2 million barrels per day, India's oil minister said there are countries in the consortium that have always sold oil to India. He also pointed to hitherto unheard of sources that New Delhi is looking to import oil from, highlighting the rising demand in India driven by an increase in per capita consumption of energy.
While the boycott of Russian oil and gas amid the Ukraine war has fueled a major energy crisis in Europe, India remains afloat by not only continuing to buy Russian energy, but also scaling up the discounted purchases. It has offset most of the drop in Russian shipments to Europe and managed to neutralize the impact of Western sanctions. Now, India's import of Russian oil in September saw a sizable jump of 18.5% from August, making it again the country's second largest crude supplier after Saudi Arabia.
An analysis by the Financial Times of Chinese and Indian customs data shows the two countries imported 11 million tons more oil from Russia in the second quarter of 2022 compared with the first quarter. Payments for Russian oil from the two countries also increased by $9 billion. The major portion belonged to India, where Russian oil imports surged from 0.66 million in the first quarter to 8.42 million in the second. As per energy cargo tracker Vortexa, the purchase of 879,000 barrels per day of Russian oil in September was the second highest in a month ever for India, after 933,000 in June. Russia's gain has been America's loss. The U.S. now has only about 4% of the Indian market, down from 10% the previous year. The purchase of Russia's refined products has also spiked, with fuel oil imports reaching 10,000 barrels per day in September, up from an average of nearly 60,000 BPD in the first quarter of 2022. Discounted crude is critical for India as it meets 83% of demand through imports. Recently, India's finance minister Nirmala Sitharaman stressed that importing oil from Russia was part of the government's inflation management strategy, which shows national interest matters to New Delhi more than anything else.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Nainan, the editor-in-chief of A Petrol Watch, a fortnightly oil and gas newsletter, now in its 25th year of publication. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Nainan. Now, India's oil minister made a categorical statement during his recent visit to the US that the country will buy oil from wherever it has to. So what message does this send across?
Yes, India's oil minister, Hardeep Puri, has been quoted saying that India will buy crude oil from wherever it has to. This has been the policy of the government of India for years, decades, and rightly so, because India today imports about 85 or 86% of its crude oil requirement. For such a big dependence, I mean, for a country which depends on imports for such a large portion, predominant portion of its requirement, what is the choice? There's no choice. India has to buy crude oil at the best prices that it can get globally. And typically, this has been the policy and the practice for decades. Typically, India signs two kinds of contracts. There are the term contracts as well as spot buying. Term contracts are usually with state-owned oil companies in producing countries, and spot is could be with state-owned as well as with private oil companies, depending on requirements of the market in India, requirements of petrol and diesel in the market in India. So, Mr. Puri was just restating the government's well-known position that the country will buy crude oil from wherever it can at the best possible prices, because it has a duty to the consumers, to the citizens of this country, to provide petrol and diesel at the best possible prices.
Now, Mr. Nainan, Russia bounced back to become India's second largest crude oil supply in September, while the war in Ukraine continues to simmer. Now, does this show the waning American influence in the new world order?
Yes, Russia was in September the second